The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
At 9.26, Ian Robertson is interested in how the brain works. He's a clinical psychologist and neuroscientist, and his latest book, How Confidence Works, gives us an intriguing insight on why we need confidence to get through life, what it is, how you can get more of it, and the trouble with too much of it. And what a pleasure it is to welcome in real life and glorious Technicolor in studio. Ian, nice to see you.
It's great to see you, Ryan. You do exist.
Not just a radio in the kitchen, you know. How have you been, by the way? Is life good? You look really well.
Privileged, you know, living in a lovely part of the world with, you know, close to family. So I know it's not like that for a lot of people. I've just been one of the lucky ones in lockdown. Yeah.
And did you write this book in lockdown?
I did. And, you know, no better way of not having to travel, not having to, you know, there's some benefits of this. I used to travel a lot and I haven't traveled in the last year and a half, so much more time to do that.
Put your head down and concentrate on the subject at hand, which is confidence. And I think that, you know, I mentioned a little bit earlier on, Ian, that a lot of people's confidence has taken a hit with the lockdown. And a lot of people have regressed. Yeah. A lot of people are kind of, and even confident people I know are putting their toe into the water of society again with a certain reluctance. I mean, they're not, I thought they were going to rush headlong into the roaring 20s. They're kind of walking in gently.
Yeah. We're creatures of habit, Ryan.
Sure.
And I can remember what it was like, you know, the night before you went back to school after the long summer holidays.
Yeah,
a wee bit of butterflies in the stomach, and because you've been doing something different. And, you know, but of course, once you're a day or two back into it and you're fine. But particularly for people who are a wee bit anxious or are not big extroverts, maybe who have been doing their college course online for a year, who have never... There's big challenges for millions of people, really, in getting back into things. Because confidence... The trouble with... the great thing about confidence is it's like a fuel additive. That it accelerates its effects, because a little bit of extra confidence makes you do a little bit more. That expands your experiences and your successes, and that multiplies over time, and that happens over a lifetime with people.
Yes.
That's why two kids with exactly the same abilities, one with a tiny bit more confidence at the beginning, that tiny difference exponentially grows and creates a much more yawning gap with time, because confidence creates new opportunities, new experiences, new skills, etc. Whereas if you hold back, you don't get that opportunity.
Does your background, class, race, wealth affect confidence, or are you born with it? I mean,
it's mainly these things.
Is that right?
Yeah. But it's not only that. Bear with me, give 30 seconds
ahead,
of the study.
No.
Several thousand twins in the UK, okay? So twins, by definition, each have the same socioeconomic background.
Yeah, sure.
They got them to self-rate their socioeconomic state, their social ladder. Where do you stand on the social ladder? 1 to 10. Most of us can rate ourselves on that. And what they found was that until adolescence, these kids were more or less the same in their self-ratings. But then, for some reason, some of the twins started to rate themselves as lower social status compared to the other twin. Yeah. And when they did that, their opportunities declined, their educational attainment declined, their drug use, they were more likely to use drugs, more likely to end up in trouble. So, and we don't understand what happened. Something happened in their adolescence that they started to perceive themselves to be of lower social status than their twin.
Well, this is why your book was so interesting. Like, you talk about, at one stage, elite athletes or indeed people who are just high achievers.
Yeah.
And like all great psychology and psychiatry, you kind of have to go back to their childhood to say what has driven them to become something a little more other than everyone else.
That's right. And it seems to be that super elite athletes, I mean,
the Tiger Woods of this world,
he seems to be that super athletes have had a tough experience in their early life. You know, I mean, parents divorce or something like that. And then what they then have is some example. They meet an Olympian. They meet someone who's inspiring in whatever the domain they're wanting to excel in, and then they have some early success experience, maybe an amateur win or something like that.
Yes.
And that kind of seems to create a recipe for really driven people who really go to the top. Now, so Tiger Woods, for example,
yes.
He had a terrible stutter as a child, and he was really bullied at school. He was really miserable, and then he. He won the American Amateur Golf Championship at a very young age. And that incredible drive, I mean, no one has won as many, I don't think, or one other golfer has won as many tournaments as he's won. Now, poor guy now, you know, is in a different state. But so that's true not just of Tiger Woods, but in general, you seem to have this adversity.
Yes.
Earlier in your life that then drives you. And that's true of prime ministers of the UK and presidents of the US. Many of them are orphans. Many of them are come from single-parent families. And it seems to be there's something about early...
Well, Bill Clinton would be a prime example of that. Came from a very poor background, but also, again, single mother to an extent.
Exactly. And you know, and Barack Obama had a tough enough life as well growing up.
Yeah.
So that seems to be that. And, you know, one of the greatest sources of confidence is mastering adversity, is getting through tough times. Because what you do there is you learn that you are not your emotions. You learn that anxiety passes. You learn that, yes, you can be low mood, you can be down, but eventually it goes.
Great.
And you learn, and if you feel anxious, so I'm thinking of the people who are, you know, maybe anxious about going into college or going back to college, yeah, having never been there. If they can just... take the step, just do it in spite of feeling anxious. And this is true of going out socially and things like that.
Yeah.
If you do things in spite of anxiety and you keep doing them, getting through the anxiety, that will build your confidence like few other things.
It's like you mentioned Sonia Sullivan. I know it's all the sporting industry,
yeah,
but Sonia Sullivan, who kind of goes, who needed to kind of break back into the elite again, having suffered a defeat. She could have gone home and said, that's the end of that. But she went incrementally. That's the way you're just describing it there.
Exactly. She's a great woman.
Yeah.
And she had this very humiliating, you know, public failure mm-hmm. in the Olympics, you know, where the expectations were so high for her. And she went back to London and she just forgot about Olympics, forgot about medals, and just said, okay, what's my target for Saturday's road race?
Yeah, yeah. Softly again, yeah.
And that's the thing about confidence. The main thing about confidence is it makes you do stuff.
Yes.
It helps you do stuff. And if you do stuff, you'll get success experiences. If you have even small success experiences, will change the chemistry of your brain. They will release dopamine in the brain's reward network, which is a natural antidepressant and a natural anti-anxiety drug. So if you can just, confidence makes you do stuff. If you can just get through stuff and do them, that will build up confidence. And once you have that, then that will multiply itself. Success leads to success.
Okay, and there is a difference though, isn't there, between the person who's confident and can back it up with a certain emotional, intellectual ability versus, excuse the language, but a bullshit artist.
Yes.
Who's like this, like is it Ally McLeod?
Right.
So describe, compare and contrast those two schools of confidence.
Yeah, Ally McLeod, of course, was he was the Scotland team manager who...
He's part of column B in this example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so Scotland had unusually qualified for the World Cup in Argentina. And he created a kind of national delusion because everyone seemed to buy into it. He created this fantasy bubble, and he was asked, for instance, what are you going to do when Scotland wins the World Cup? As he had said, he says, win it again.
A spoof.
It was the most, and so that kind of bubble, that was a kind of farcical bubble of overconfidence, but it shows you that confidence is enormously contagious.
Yeah.
And it is contagious because it buys you status, because it lifts people's mood, and that's the source of...
But it's a debased currency, is it not, if it's not delivered upon?
Well, yes, it is.
But it's finite then.
But the problem is... it buys you so much in the short and medium term.
Is that enough?
That it can be self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
So Adam Newman, who created the WeWork, for instance, I mean, so based on the most inflated overconfidence, he was going to cure, you know, stop world wars and stop orphans existing in the world. But he ended up with a multi-billion company valuation. Yeah. And when it finally, the valuation failed, he went out with a huge packet. And so, I mean, with billions of payoff. And so that's the trouble with overconfidence.
Yeah. You know, in Line of Duty recently, just as you're talking like that, there was a great discovery of somebody did something bad. I'm worried about giving too much away. But the line that was so good, and it was an example of somebody failing upwards, up the ladder, getting promoted and promoted.
Yeah.
But sometimes they were getting promoted to get them out of the way.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're getting promoted because they were stuck for somebody to put in the job. But either way, they were just eminently unqualified for the job. But this kind of... the confidence of the mediocre middle guy who just drifts up the ladder. You go, that's a strange type of confidence, isn't it?
Well, no, but generally, overconfidence will, in a standard interview panel where your actual abilities are not technically tested, will get you the job more likely than if you're less confident.
That's terribly unfair.
It's unfair, it doesn't make you any better than job. In fact, as you were saying there, it makes you work.
On the contrary,
worth the job.
Yeah.
And this penalises women enormously.
Women
particularly. Because women on average have less overconfidence than men.
Why?
They're much... So if you give a group of male and female students a geography test, okay, and you get... So the men, say, get 7 out of 10 and the women maybe get 7.5 out of 10. And then you say, what scores do you think you got on the test? The men will say 8.5 and the women will say 6.5.
And sure enough, then, the results will show.
No, but actually the women have been slightly better, but they've underrated them.
But
the women then are less likely to volunteer to take part in a further national competition, to take part in a general knowledge competition. Because they're more realistic in their self-appraisal of their abilities, they don't get the same benefits of the bullshitting, forgive the term.
No, it's a good term for the day that's in it.
Yeah.
So why is there a gender imbalance with regards to confidence? Is that because society has built that up, or is it a more basic...
It's largely society.
It's societal,
built it
okay.
Up.
So that
and you know, for instance, women who are bigger and women who feel more physically formidable are more confident than women who are smaller or less. It's as primitive as that.
Yeah.
It started, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, men, when muscles were the main thing.
Big man, big confidence.
Man. And so the whole history of beating up women, you know, that kind of physical, basic primitive physical strength has led to women having to adapt to these primitive imbalances and dumps. It is, but we live in a civilization now where these Darwinian principles are no longer relevant.
Yeah.
And actually, we need more women in senior positions because they're less vulnerable to the addictive and distorting effects of overconfidence and power addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, until that is that imbalance is corrected, you know, I don't think the world will be very safe.
No, it won't.
Place.
It won't.
How are we in terms of confidence of a race? You know, national confidence.
Yes.
So, for example, just as you were talking there, I was thinking, whenever I say to my girls, I say to my daughters, obviously, I'll say, you know, you look beautiful today, and no, I don't. I said, well, hang on a second, we're going to correct this at from the get go. You're an Irish woman. You're going to say, thank you.
Yeah.
You're not going to say, no, I don't.
Right? Yeah.
So do you know what I mean? This is a micro example of what should be a national thing. Because in Ireland, we tend to kowtow a little bit and we kind of bump into somebody. We say, sorry. We don't say, excuse me. You know, it's a strange thing.
It's so interesting you say that, because there actually is an objective measure of bullshitting, which is you in the PISA study of ability across OECD countries.
Mm.
They say, how familiar are you with these mathematical terms from zero, never heard of them, to 10, understand it completely and know it? And they insert five fictitious terms that don't exist in it. And so you get the actual measure of how bullshitty a culture is. And sure enough, which are the most bullshitty countries?
Yeah.
America and Canada. Which are the least bullshitty countries? Well, Scotland's at the very lowest. Ireland's pretty low as well. But you're right. We have this tendency to to self-deprecate, to apologize in advance, and seek reassurance. Oh, am I talking rubbish? The trouble with that kind of reassurance seeking and constant self-deprecation, it does actually, the words you say to yourself are important, and it does eat into your confidence.
Yes.
And what's more, it communicates that to the other person. So if you don't appear confident in yourself, why should the other person be confident in you? So we have to be careful we don't fall into the habit of constantly undercutting ourselves, constantly seeking reassurance. You know, this is probably rubbish. Oh, I look terrible today. I'm sorry, it's such a mess. So all this kind of stuff.
Just look up a bit more.
Yeah, and the posture is important as well.
Yeah, the shoulders have to be out of it, but without being a strut, of course.
Yeah, well, without being a strut, I mean, the kind of... power pose research hasn't panned out as being validated, but what has panned out is if you constrict your body position.
Yes.
So you know what it's like. You know, students coming into a professor's, they'll tend to make themselves smaller. We tend to make ourselves smaller with more dominant people. Women maybe a little more than men unconsciously. When you do that, that does undercut your confidence.
There's a story about Marilyn Monroe walking along midtown Manhattan with a friend, and the friend said, she was wearing a hat and a scarf, and the friend said, "How come you're not being stopped by anyone? Like, you're Marilyn Monroe." And she said, "Well, obviously I'm in kind of disguise." She said, "Do you want to see what it's like being Marilyn Monroe?" And the guy said, "Yes, please." She took the hat off, the scarf, she put the hair left and right, and she put the lipstick on, and she walked down the street. She couldn't move for half a sec. Confidence of appearance. And I talk about national confidence. If you've got national confidence versus patriotism versus national pride.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of, that can be a dangerous combination too.
Yeah.
You look at history of time. In your book, Ian, you talk about Kennedy's aspirations for the moon. Yeah. That is a beautiful confidence because it's scientific and it's national and it's aspirational. And if you're a citizen of a country that has such lofty aspirations, that confidence can be contagious.
It is. And you know what? Ireland came through the biggest drop in the standard of living in the Great Recession, the 2008 recession.
Yeah.
And I was so proud to be, I'm an Irish citizen, have been for 20 years. I was so proud to be part of the sheer grit. I know there was a huge amount of pain and suffering, I know that. But the huge grit that people showed in getting through that. And I think that experience of toughing it through the whole troika and all that has meant that that's one of the reasons we've had a pretty mature response to COVID.
Yes, okay, interesting.
Yeah. And I think that that kind of sense of collective confidence, because collective confidence is more than the sum of the individual confidences.
Sure.
We can be self-deprecating as individuals, but as a group, we believe that the as a nation, we feel confident. And that is absolutely true. And that will multiply, that will affect our economy, that will affect our well-being. Yeah. Because one of the great antidotes to anxiety and poor mental health is confidence.
Yes.
It's very difficult to feel confident if you don't feel in control of your emotions, and vice versa. So
That comes with the territory. And I just see we are coming down with comments and questions. We could be here for about 2 days, which is a reflection of the interest in the subject.
Yeah.
And that's why people would be able to pick up your book after they've heard the interview today. Venture capitalists, I mean, you write that they're often more interested in entrepreneurs that have had previously failed ventures.
Yes, that's right.
Now, venture capitalists have a mixed response in countries like this in times like these. But tell me a little about that.
Yeah, well, it's the scars on your back. It's one of the problems. How you deal with failure is one of the great sources of confidence. Because, this happens to kids at school, for instance, who, if they fail an exam, they can sometimes, that can become a fixed mindset about themselves.
Yes.
And if you respond to failure by saying, "Look, this is actually an opportunity for me to learn how not to fail in future," that literally allows the frontal lobes of your brain to open up to process the information and make it more likely that you will learn something from this so that you will not fail in future. That's one reason the venture capitalists like the people, because they've been forced to learn from the mistakes. Mm-hmm. But it's really important that you believe you can change. The worst thing is to have a fixed mindset about your abilities. Yeah. Oh, I'm just not an entrepreneur. I'm just no good. I can't play music. I'm just no good academically. These kind of fixed mindsets sabotage your ability to use confidence.
You're your own worst enemy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, why do people go red even if they're confident? I don't know if that's a question you can answer.
Well, I mean, blushing, some people blush more than others. Yeah. It's a conditioned habit that's part of the sympathetic autonomic nervous system responding to challenge or stress. So that doesn't necessarily have to go with the thoughts you have inside your mind, because confidence is essentially the thoughts you have.
Okay, yeah. Question for Ian from Margaret. Does confidence need to be topped up at regular intervals in order to maintain your level of confidence? This question is coming from a person who was a very shy twin. They were back to growing up. But when I went to college, I came out of myself. However, I find that if I'm not putting myself out there constantly, I feel my confidence decreasing.
That's interesting. Yeah, we have different temperaments. Some of us are more outgoing than others temperamentally. But we're also creatures of habit. So if we're in the habit of putting ourselves out there and getting mixing, that habit will maintain itself. But if you don't top up the habit, as Margaret says, if you don't top it up, then yes, our temperament can come through and we can revert. And that's happened to a lot of people in COVID.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people who temperamentally are maybe not terribly outgoing, a bit anxious, they need to really muster their confidence to get out there and to top up these habits that they maybe had beforehand.
Perfect. My husband always commands, says Barbara in Glasnevin, always commands more attention when he repeats what I have just said.
That's great. That is great. Oh. I mean, but he's basically magpieing her as well.
Oh, I know. But, you know, and men, and I do not accept myself for this. Men are... The relationship between men and women, the degree to which men consciously and unconsciously undercut their women's confidence is just, it's formidable. And there's so many ways it happens.
Okay, okay. Well, I won't necessarily agree with you. No. Which in itself, I think, answers the question. Yeah, all right. Jennifer was saying, brilliant discussion of how confidence impacts our lives. Women are penalized by lack of confidence more than men. Self-appraisal of confidence has a gender bias, it seems. Sean says, can someone overcompensate and become way more confident in their business life and then have zero confidence in their personal life?
Yeah, they can indeed, because confidence isn't a general feeling good about yourself. That's self-esteem, and that's different. Self-esteem doesn't get you success in life the way confidence does. Confidence is linked to specific action. So you can be confident in the sports field and very unconfident in the nightclub, for instance. Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. And that's why you have to build confidence in specific domains through doing stuff and getting the success experiences that help change the chemistry of your brain to build more confidence.
That's it. And even doing this show, I would display a different level of what you might call confidence, whatever. Yeah. But if you were to meet me walking out in the park or something, I'm much more...
Exactly.
This is more of a...
This is your mental uniform you wear.
That's a great uniform.
That's a great
way
you can
of
do things
it.
With you. Yeah, that's right.
So you'd be a bit more low-key and say, nice to meet you, whatever. Which exactly. We wouldn't be saying, good morning, did I tell you what I just read last night? It's really interesting. How are you? It's going, oh, your man's a pain in the neck. Yeah. All right. As an educator, like many of my colleagues, I find it's not the case for example, Generation Z millennials do not have confidence. The opposite is true. Misplaced sense of confidence, little supporting their confident beliefs in their own ability and assignment work. Very worrying is that they can border on delusion, a fixed, firm, false belief. Would Dr. Robinson argue confidence only exists where there's a firm foundation for claims made?
Well, you know what? We always have to push ourselves beyond what we're absolutely certain we can do. That's what confidence is. So you always have to fake it a little bit.
Yeah. Well,
you always do something before you're quite ready. Mm. Okay. Perfectionism is the enemy of confidence, because you'll never allow yourself to be. So in a sense, yes, perhaps, but no, you can't always be 100% certain. You have to just make that leap sometimes, a little bit of a leap.
Take the leap, take the chance. Yeah. Can you discuss how women's confidence can be knocked once they enter motherhood, on how their whole world flips upside down, and how when a woman returns to the corporate world after maternity leave, she can be told in year-end appraisals she has received a below expectation because she was out for half the year on maternity leave? What does Ian think about performance ratings in the private sector and how grade affects confidence. Also, I'd love to hear more discussion on confidence in women in the workforce and how to build up their confidence while returning back from maternity leave.
So. Yeah, that's a, I've seen colleagues returning from maternity leave, and I've seen just that, how lacking in confidence they are. It's like, yeah. But it's a similar to what happens with the school holidays coming back, that kind of nervousness in school holidays. But the fact is that there are systematic biases happening, unconscious among their male colleagues, who don't properly give them credit for the fact that they've been off, producing children for the country.
Yes, yes, yeah, that's, which is a job in itself. Yeah. Regarding confidence in Monsters, Inc., Mike, the smaller guy, and Sully, the larger one, show how nature compensated by giving smaller creatures increased confidence. Think how small dogs take charge over large dogs despite size difference. It's nature's way of compensating for a lack in other areas. And of course, I was only thinking about this the other day. If you take it like the Lion King, it's Pumbaa and Timon. Yeah. And in Of Mice and Men, you've got the big guy and the little guy, which I always think is a similar thing. But I don't know if there's too much to read into that. I want to ask, I'm a super efficient, that's Kieran in Glasnevin, a very efficient, confident man. I only have limited education, but got an amazing upbringing. My father always drummed punctuality, discipline, etc. into me. And I expect the same from everyone else. Am I just being impatient, or is this a good thing to be?
Look, absolutely. You know, if you've had a... Having a good education is a huge advantage for confidence. If you have people who manage in spite of the things that would normally subtract from your confidence, if you manage to, through self-pride and self-discipline, to do that, that's a brilliant thing to do, to have that kind of self-concept and not be dragged down by a feeling of, oh, I didn't have much of an education, therefore, and to feel your social status is lower because of that.
Yes.
You know, to ignore these things, none of them are inevitable, none of them are unchangeable. For you to do what this chap says is absolutely the correct thing to do.
Your book is not only does it offer these lovely sporting and historical snapshots and their effect on confidence, but also it offers a broader manual for life. And I think it's a fascinating read, and it will be a welcome addition to anyone's shelf in any country, but especially in Ireland, where confidence it needs to be discussed a little more. Ian, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Really
Ryan.
Good to. I think you're my first guest in the radio studio, I think, in a year or thereabouts. But either way, it's great to see you but particularly nice to start the return of human beings in the radio studio with me today with you. So go well, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Good to see you as always. The book, the name of it is How Confidence Works. It's by Ian Robertson, published by Bantam Press. Available for pre-order at your local bookshop now, and it'll be out on the 3rd of June. So be sure to pre-order that. And as I say, then 3rd of June, head down to your local bookshop and pick up a copy. You will not be disappointed. Ian, thanks again.
Thanks, Ryan.
Back shortly.